the Book of Judges. It's a tale of chaos unleashed, of violence unchained, and of a moral compass spinning wildly out of control. Ancient Israel's story? Perhaps. But as we peel back the pages, we'll find a mirror reflecting our own tumultuous times. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Sound familiar? Well, join us over the next few weeks as we study the Book of Judges, ancient wisdom for modern chaos. Our story begins now.
But Judges chapter 19. Let's read this passage. In those days, Israel had no king. Now a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But she was unfaithful to him. She left him and went back to her parents' home in Bethlehem, Judah. After she'd been there for 4 months, her husband went to her to persuade her to return. She had with him his servant and 2 donkeys. She took him into her parents' home, and when her father saw him, he gladly welcomed him. His father-in-law, the woman's father, prevailed on him to stay. So he remained with him 3 days, eating and drinking and sleeping there. On the 4th day, they got up early and he prepared to leave. But the woman's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh yourself with something to eat, then you can go." So the two of them sat down to eat and drink together. Afterwards, the woman's father said, "Please stay tonight and enjoy yourself." And when the man got up to go, his father-in-law persuaded him, so he stayed there that night. On the morning of the 5th day, when he arose to go, the woman's father said, "Refresh yourself, wait till afternoon." So the two of them ate together. Then when the man, with his concubine and his servant, got up to leave, his father-in-law, the woman's father, said, "Now look, it's almost evening. Spend the night here, the day is nearly over. Stay and enjoy yourself. Early tomorrow morning, you can get up and be on your way home." But unwilling to stay another night, the man left and went towards Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with his 2 saddled donkeys and his concubine. When they were near Jebus and the day was almost gone, the servant said to his master, "Come, let's stop at this city of the Jebusites and spend the night." His master replied, "No, we won't go into any city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Gibeah." He added, "Come, let's try to reach Gibeah or Ramah and spend the night in one of those places." So they went on and the sun set as they neared Gibeah and Benjamin. There they stopped to spend the night. They went and sat in the city square, but no one took them in for the night. That evening, an old man from the hill country of Ephraim, who was living in Gibeah, the inhabitants of the place were Benjaminites, came in from his work in the fields. When he looked and saw the traveller in the city square, the old man asked, "Where are you going? Where did you come from?" He answered, "We're on our way from Bethlehem to Judah, to a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim where I live. I've been to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to the house of the Lord. No one has taken me in for the night. We have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves, your servants. Me, the woman, and the young man with us, we don't need anything." "You're welcome at my house," the old man said. "Let me supply whatever you need. Only don't spend the night in the square." So he took him into his house and fed his donkeys. After they'd washed their feet, they had something to eat and drink. While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so that we can have sex with him." The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this outrageous thing. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But as for this man, don't do such an outrageous thing." But the men would not listen to him. So the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight. When her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. Then the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. When he reached home, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them into all the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it was saying to one another, "Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Just imagine, we must do something, so speak up." Three generations. That is all it has taken. Three generations from Moses parting the Red Sea to this. Three generations from Joshua's conquest to a scene so horrific that many preachers skip over it. There are no songs written about Judges 19. There are three generations from "Choose this day whom you will serve" to a moment that makes your stomach turn. And the big question has to be, doesn't it? How does this happen? How did God's people, who should know better, end up worse than the pagans they were meant to replace? I'm going to warn you again, this passage is disturbing. This passage should disturb you. That is its purpose. When a critic calls this one of the Bible's moral horrors, they are absolutely right to be horrified. Although they then dismiss the Bible and say it can't be God's word, can it? And the question is, do they actually understand why this passage is here? Because I want to say tonight, this passage isn't Christianity's embarrassment. It's Christianity's diagnosis. See, we've been tracing this theme through Judges, haven't we? In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. We've seen that in the individual judges. We've seen that in the families, like Gideon's, in the religious corruption of Micah and his hired Levite. But tonight we see it at its absolute worst. In this passage that's meant to shock us, horrify us, make us recoil and ask, how on earth did God's people end up here? And the question that drives this passage is simple but devastating. What does it look like when everyone does what is right in their own eyes? Here's the devastating answer. The answer that should disturb us all this evening. It leads to a people who should know better, becoming worse than those they were meant to replace. Just think about that for a moment. Israel were called out of the nations to be a light to the nations. God's people are meant to show the world what it looks like when people live under God's authority. See, these people are the ones with the law, the ones with the covenant, the ones with the promises. But by the end of tonight's passage, they make Sodom and Gomorrah look civilized. They out-horrify the Canaanites they're meant to be displacing. The very people here who should have known better, the Levites, of all people who teaches God's law, the Israelite city that should be showing hospitality, or they become the monsters. And this isn't just ancient history. This is a warning. This is what happens when any of us, individually, as families, as churches, abandon God's authority and live by what seems right in our own eyes. Because as we'll see, the slope is steeper than we think. The fall is faster than we imagine. And the bottom is darker than we ever dreamed. How does this happen? How do people with every spiritual advantage end up here? Well, we're going to trace the deadly path. Well, firstly, we need to see how the horror begins. And it begins exactly where you expect. As we've gone through Judges, this is what we've seen. It begins with a small compromise that seems perfectly reasonable at the time. First 10 verses showing us this. Living by our own sight starts with putting ourselves first. I think the first 10 verses are probably more complicated than the rest. And as we read through these verses, you might have thought to yourself, well, there's not much really that wrong with these verses. It seems fine. I mean, especially compared to what's going to come next. But as I've been dwelling on this passage over this week, each part of these verses just strikes you as weirder and weirder. Did you notice? Have a look down at verse 1. So verse 1, we get that familiar refrain, in those days there was no king in Israel. So we've seen in Judges, the point is God was supposed to be their king. And no king here means they've rejected God's authority. They are living for themselves. But then we meet our main character, a Levite. If you remember back to Judges 17, we met another Levite. He was an absolute walking disaster. So as we meet another Levite, our expectations should be low. And sadly, we're not disappointed. Just think about what a Levite is supposed to be. Levites, they're to work in the tabernacle. Levites, their job was to look after God's word, to teach it to the people. Levites administer God's law to the nation. They're meant to be the spiritual leaders, those who know better. So when we find this Levite, he's living as a drifter in a remote hill country. I mean, the text literally says he's sojourning. He's wandering about. Alarm bells should be ringing. That's not what he should be doing. That's not where he should be. But then it carries on. We discover he's got a concubine. That's strike number two. You take a concubine when you already have a wife. But there's no mention of a wife here, is there? Plus, as the Levite should know, God's design is one man with one woman forever. I mean, something's gone wrong, hasn't it? And it goes wrong even more, verse 2. Something's gone wrong between them. She's either been unfaithful in her marriage or she's just been unfaithful by running away. Whatever's happened, she's ended up back in her father's house. And so our spiritual leader, does he immediately pursue reconciliation? No. Look how long he waits. 4 months. Talk about pastoral urgency there. 4 months. And then it carries on. This is where it gets interesting. See, when he makes the trip, just look what happens. The father-in-law does something, well, beautiful, really. He provides incredible hospitality. Day after day after day after day. Fine dining, comfortable beds, generous provision. Now, we don't tend to think about hospitality too much in our culture. Hospitality is a big thing in the Bible. In fact, if you were to think hospitality, you're taken all the way back to Genesis 18. Genesis 18, this is important for the rest of this passage. Genesis 18, we're told by the book of Hebrews that Abraham entertained angels. He is the model of hospitality. Everyone who follows is meant to echo Abraham. And this man does the same thing. Fine dining for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, verse 4. Eating, drinking, sleeping, verse 5. On the fourth day, the Levite gets up to leave. He's persuaded to stay for another day. Then at night, he gets up to leave again. The father-in-law continues to be hospitable. Same happens again, verse 8. Levite gets up to leave. He's still being provided for. The guy's going above and beyond. He gets to the evening and the father says, verse 9, oh, come on, just spend the night. Don't go outside. Go in the morning. But then the Levite, verse 10, he's had enough. What's right in his sight, despite the safety, the comfort, the generosity, what's right in his sight is to head out. Head out into the darkness, head out into the dangerous night with his concubine and donkeys. I mean, that's just odd, isn't it? In fact, that's not just odd, that's foolish. In fact, it's not just foolish, it's dangerous. But it's what seems right to him, that's what he does. See, his personal preference trumps wisdom or safety or even gratitude. If you put all that together, you get that pattern. The Levite, who should have known God's way, is in fact choosing his own way. At every decision point, he's following what seems right to him. And each choice, it just seems reasonable, doesn't it? It just seems understandable. That's how living by your own sight works. It doesn't start with a dramatic rebellion. It starts with a small compromise, a personal preference, you might say, putting ourselves first. It starts with what I want matters more than what God says. That's the start of this avalanche that's going to go all the way through to chapter 21. Living by our own sight starts by putting ourselves first. But now we see where that path leads. It leads straight into darkness. In fact, it leads into hell itself. Living by our own sight leads to death and horror. Verses 10 to 30. You see, our travelling party, they load up their donkeys, they head out into the night. Because of that random decision to leave the safety of hospitality, they find themselves caught out as the darkness falls. So the servant, he suggests stopping in Jebus, that is Jerusalem, but it's still controlled by the Canaanites. And here's the ironic statement, it becomes devastating later on. Just listen to what he says, verse 12. His master replied, "No, we won't go into any city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Gibeah." Do you hear his reasoning? We can't stay with the pagans, because, I mean, who knows what the Canaanites might do to us. But Gibeah, that's where God's people live. We're going to be safe there. Remember those words? So they go on. The sun is setting. They approach Gibeah. Gibeah belongs to the Benjaminites. We're told that twice. It's important for what's going to happen next. They push on to Gibeah, a city belonging to Benjamin. The sun sets. They enter the city gates. They sit down in the town square. They wait for someone to offer them hospitality. Remember, that is a big thing. Hospitality is a big deal. It's exactly what God's law says should happen. But verse 15, we should be horrified by this. They went and sat in the city square, but no one took them in for the night. God's people, God's law, God's city, and nothing. Not one person opens their doors. And finally, we meet an old man. Do you notice the old man? One, he's old. Two, he's a foreigner. He spots them and he asks them where they're going. The Levite explains, he even mentions he's heading to the house of the Lord. And this old man, who seems to still remember how covenant community works, he takes them in. And then we're back in Genesis 18 again. Hospitality, food, safety, fellowship. But all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. Actually, not just a knock, is it? It's a pounding, shouting. The demand comes through the door. It should chill your blood. Verse 22, "Bring out the man who came to your house so that we can have sex with him." Wait, stop. Did we get the GPS wrong? Where are we? We're in Gibeah, right? That's Israel. This is God's people. These are the people who have the law, who knows God's ways, who are supposed to be different. We've talked about Genesis 18. These words right here are a perfect copy of Genesis 19. Word for word, what the men of Sodom said to Lot. The chapter right after Abraham's beautiful hospitality, we get Sodom's sexual violence. And right after this generous hospitality, what do we get? We get the exact same evil, but this time from God's own people. The old man goes out to reason with them. "Don't be so vile," he pleads. Don't do this outrageous thing. But tragically, just like Lot before him, he offers the alternatives, his own virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine. We've seen through Judges, haven't we? Women, and they're degrading as we go through, from the named woman, Axter at the start, to this here. It's going to get worse by chapter 21. But notice the phrase, "Do whatever you wish." Let's put that literally so it sounds familiar. Do what is right in your eyes. It's the phrase again, isn't it? Even in this man's attempt to help, he gets caught in the same trap. But notice, the men don't want that. The men want the Levite. It is Sodom all over again. Except it's worse. Verse 25. We read perhaps the most despicable act in all of Scripture. The NIV has tamed it for us. The men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and shoved her outside to them. And they raped her and abused her throughout the night. And at dawn, they let her go. The Levite, God's teacher, the man who should be protecting the woman, the man who should lead, the man who should know God's heart, seizes his own concubine, thrusts her out the door to save his own skin. It is despicable, isn't it? They abuse her all night long, all night. And at dawn, broken and battered, she crawls back to the house where, have a look down at verse 26. You can see that the author is not impressed. where her master, not her husband anymore, but her master was staying. She collapses at the threshold, hands reaching out towards the door. Meanwhile, it seems, the Levite himself is sleeping peacefully through the night. He opens the door in the morning, and he's ready to go on his own way, and he literally trips over a body. "Get up, let's go," he says. There's no answer. He loads her onto his donkey like baggage and heads home. And then when he gets there, he takes a knife and cuts her into 12 pieces. In fact, it's the same word again. As he seizes her, pushed her outside, he seizes the knife and cuts her to bits. To him, she's an object. She's just a thing. And here's where we might have self-censored it. Find the verse which says she was dead. The text doesn't say she's dead. It's grim. It's horrific. It is living by our own sight, and it leads to death and horror. He then ships her remains across Israel, and the nation is horrified. Verse 30, just see what they're saying. "Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt." This is the worst moment in Israel's history, according to their own people. And do you know what's missing from this entire nightmare? God. Did you spot that? There's no prayer. There's no seeking God's face. There's no divine intervention. There's just silence. I mean, when Abraham raised the knife over his son Isaac to slaughter him, an angel stopped him. When this Levite raises the knife, no one stops him. No substitutes provided, just horror, followed by horror, followed by horror. This is where living by your own sight leads. This is where living without God leads. The Levite thought he'd be safe with our people more than with the pagans. But God's people here become more dangerous than the Canaanites they were meant to replace. Already said, but Richard Dawkins, in his book Against Christianity, says this is one of the Bible's moral horrors. And he's right, isn't he? But he misses the point entirely, because this story is not told to glamorize evil. It is told to expose it. This is not a moral guise. This is a moral warning. And the horror, the disgust that you're feeling as we read this, is exactly how you're supposed to feel. So here we are, staring into the abyss, the absence of God, hell. We've just seen what happens when everyone does what is right in their own eyes. We've watched God's people become worse than the pagans they're meant to replace. It's all downhill from here. And the question now is unavoidable. How do we make sure this never becomes our story? You only have to read the news online to see this stuff still happens today. Well, first of all, we need to let this passage do what it's, I assume, already done. Horrify us. We don't want to domesticate this story. We don't want to explain it away. We want to let it shock us, to disturb us. Because the moment we become comfortable with compromise is the moment we're already on this path. Now, the Levite did not wake up one morning and decide to be a monster. He made a series of small, seemingly reasonable decisions. Convenience over calling, preference over principle, self-protection over sacrificial love. And each choice just made the next one easier. It's like padding your expenses account by £5. 6 months later, you're embezzling thousands. The first compromise doesn't seem dangerous, but that's why it's so deadly. See, that's how it works, all the way through Judges. That's how a people who should know better become worse than those they're meant to replace. It's not just one dramatic fall, is it? It's thousands and thousands of tiny steps away from God's authority. So here's what must grip our hearts. Before we make decisions, ask, well, what does God say? Not what feels right to me. In your marriage, when you're hurt, when you're angry, do you want to withdraw and strike back? Or do you follow God's design of forgiveness and love? Do you follow what's right in your own eyes or what God says? As you parent, when your children challenge you, when culture is pulling them away, when you feel exhausted and want to take the easy path, do you follow God's wisdom for raising your children or what seems right to you in that moment? In your work, where you're tempted to cut corners, when everyone else is compromising around you, when integrity is going to cost you, do you live by God's standards or by what feels practical? In your suffering, when life doesn't make sense, when God seems silent, when you want to give up, will you continue to trust his promises or will you start believing your feelings? I think right now as we sit here, you're probably thinking, I would never do this. But the Levite, I'm sure, felt the same thing. These choices are happening all the time. They're happening in your marriage in this week, in your parenting today, in your work tomorrow. See, Judges 19 is screaming at us that there is no neutral ground. You're either submitting to the true king of the universe or you're walking towards Gibeah. The same choice that faced Israel here faces us tonight. Are we people of God's words or people who do right in our own eyes? Will we submit to the king who gave his life for us or will we trust our own wisdom? See, the slope here is steeper than we think. The fall is faster than we imagine. But the king, the true king, is stronger than we know. And his grace is deeper than our failure. Joshua says, choose this day whom you will serve. Choose to live under the authority of the one who loves you most. Choose to say no to the voice that whispers, trust yourself. Because the alternative is not freedom. The alternative is Gibeah. The alternative is hell. And none of us want to be there, do we?
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Any questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com. I'll see you again next time.